Morning. I am making this meditation quite personal, and I hope that that's all right. I've spent the last more than 30 years working with people who live in poverty, many living in destitution, in fear, or in violent aggression. And it's clear that often they don't believe that tomorrow can be any different from today or from yesterday. This has been a long and frequently difficult journey for me, an unpredictable one that's been fraught with moments, many moments of doubt, and an anxiety that's sometimes difficult to quell, particularly at the beginning. The experience continues to be challenging, compelling, and demanding. Tlamakasapa is a large village of 6,200 people. I've worked there for the last 19 years. But I'm going to talk today about personal experiences that actually shifted the way I think, believe, and feel. Events that have become defining moments for me, that were embedded in everyday life when I encountered people who only at first seemed very different from myself. Events that caused me to pause and to reflect on human behavior, including my own, caused me to reflect on the nature of poverty and its resolution. And these experiences continue to pile up, often intensely. Life is very close up and personal. And sometimes the smallest incident provides a wealth of knowledge. So I'm going to give several stories, and I hope I can do it in the time allocation. Please bear with me. The first one is about a woman in a yellow dress that I met when I was a very young grad in Botswana, in southern Africa. And I was a nursing instructor charged with developing a public health program for nurses in the deserts of the Kalahari. And I recall watching the student giving a nutrition demonstration to a small group of women. And there was one woman that caught my eye. She had a yellow dress on, and she was always smoothing the cotton of her dress. And she was listening to what the student was saying. And the student was mixing green leaves to make a porridge for young children, a weaning porridge. And at one point, the student was very keen. She was doing her absolute best to convey the information that she thought the ladies would benefit from. And at one point, she said, "If you add an egg to the child's porridge, that'll add protein, and your weaning diet for the child will be even richer." And the woman in the yellow dress looked down and looked up, and I thought she was speaking directly to me. And she said, "Don't you think if I had an egg, I would give it to my child?" In that moment, I suddenly understood something really important. It was a game changer for me. I had thought that my task was to convey information, to educate. And somehow, despite my formal education, I had failed to grasp the immensity of the political and social determinants that form a context of people's lives. I had underestimated, I didn't understand, basically, how there are so many factors that impinge and form the way we live. I had thought the problem was lack of information. I didn't know how to do a critical analysis of a context, how to do a contextual analysis, despite my education. This was the embarrassing part. So how did I miss that? That brief moment changed the way that I looked at the world, how I understood people and their actions. And I moved from a charitable perspective, giving things from my pocket or what I had left over, to understanding the developmental process of personal and social change. It is a privilege to work with the poor and the destitute. Perhaps you've heard that phrase before, but I understand that they act as our mirror. We see ourselves in that mirror, our reflection, and sometimes it's not pretty. I must ask, in looking at my reflection, who am I? What do I believe in? What's my role here on earth during this lifetime? I come face to face with myself over and over again, and I begin to dwell on the important questions in life. I am tested again and again. How much? How long? I developed in that process a thicker skin, not quite so sensitive to what others think, a clearer vision of what I'm aiming for, and a sense of discernment. What's rubbish? Who do I listen to? What considered opinions do I attend to? Because I can tell you, everyone who walks into our office has an opinion and is willing to tell us what to do and how to do it within 3 minutes of arrival. That's true. Shift from 1977 in Botswana to 1985 on the Sudanese-Ethiopian border, I had become somehow the medical director of a camp of 60,000. The total camp was 100,000, but our portion was 60,000 people, if you can imagine. And in those early months, people arrived so thin, you could see the bones under their skin. Was I prepared to be the medical director? No, of course I wasn't. But we step up to the plate, don't we, when the job is handed to us? Because we had started off with 2,000, and within 6 weeks, there was 60,000. And their little tents, given by UNICEF and Oxfam, stretched as far as you could imagine, as far as the horizon could see. And it was so hot, more than 40 degrees. And I thought, man, if I had known it was going to be that hot, I never would have accepted this job. But the people themselves provided the only relief from the desert. It's like, so I began to really focus in on people's faces and on the clothes that they were wearing. Come close. They provided the relief from the tediousness of day by day handing out food so that they could eat a little cups of water, everybody with their little Oxfam orange cup. I don't know if you remember those. And the children would sit on mats and drink from those cups. There was hundreds of them. And one day, two refugees, both men dressed in near rags, they approached me and they showed me two flour sacks with the gift from the United States, the people of the United States of America, printed on the outside. And they spoke to me quietly, hesitantly, through an interpreter. They had just come from the weekly food distribution. And they explained that for the past 3 weeks, their allocation had been two-thirds of the allocated wheat ration. They held open their bags so that I could see what was inside, and it was an unappetizing gray flour, not anything that we would get excited about, but they knew that without the full allocation, they would not be able to feed their children for that week. Their children with skin visibly stretched over bone would get nothing at the end of the week. We all knew that, standing there in that hot sun, and I got annoyed, and I said, okay, let's go talk to the camp coordinator. And we got in the truck and I drove over there and I explained to him what was happening as though he didn't know already. And he glanced inside and he turned to the two men and he said something in a different language that I had no idea what he said. And he turned to me and he very calmly said, Susan, don't worry about it. I'll look after it. And I said, oh, good. One less problem in this chaos that we are living in. And later the translator told me what the coordinator had said. You will get what you are given. If you dare complain to the Canadian again, you will be punished. And when I heard that in the evening, tears, angry tears, came to my eyes. I said, how could I have reacted so simplistically? A reactive response to a potentially very risky situation for those two men. The multiple meanings of something so basic for human existence, for human survival, food as sustenance for landless people, escaping famine and war, living out the consequences of political decisions made by people thousands of miles from them, food in the guise of charitable foreign aid, arriving too little and too late, food as greedy corruption, and food as a means of punishment and control. Desperately needing food we were choking on the dust of that grimy flower. Later that night, I cried for the people and for my own naivety. When a contradiction appears in flesh and blood, when we live it, we are never the same again. That disturbance cuts deep and creates an oozing wound that doesn't heal. And when the contradictions start to accumulate, piling up one on another, oozing slowly, they become intolerable. And I began to search, increasingly driven for meaningful purpose and to know what I was doing. I've lived and worked internationally for 30 years, more than 30 years. And it has been 19 of those years in Tlamacasapa. But I've learned to become my own research instrument, to trust what goes on with me, to open my senses, my eyes, my ears, my mouth, my sense of touch, so that I'm not afraid to come up and console someone when they're shedding bitter tears of abuse or of disappointment. I didn't grow up that way. I had to learn it as an adult. I'm going to repeat something that I said yesterday, is that people who live with insecurity, those that live within poverty, which is indeed a form of oppression, much less the corruption that we all know is occurring in Mexico and in many other places at this time. When we live and work with people who are insecure and possess little vision for their future, and often will say, "I don't know what to do, tell me." I've often asked myself, "I don't know what to do either. But let's take our best guess." When we're working in this type of environment, there is no quick and dirty solutions. We're in it for the long haul. Because we're talking about the shift within the hearts and minds and hands of men and women, including our own. So there's no rapid fire intervention that will work. We can't take one little piece out of the context. We must understand the context, all those determinants. Because if we come in and say, "Oh, I'm only going to feed the hungry," and we pull out that piece, and we don't understand the rest of the dynamic, we're interfering, we're making an intervention, and we don't know, we have no idea what the consequences will be. And they're often harmful. In Tlama, when the government came in and put in a pumping system, only trained two fellows, those fellows took control of all of the water and now sell it as an economic commodity to everyone else. It shifted from something we all need, water, from a free resource to an economic commodity that is sold. Did they understand the context? Maybe. Did they want a quick and dirty solution? You betcha. And that isn't the way it works. We must understand the dynamic, the relationships, the power struggles, who's making the decisions. And all that takes time. One day, a physician named Peter came to visit us. This is in Tlama. It's about 10 years ago. And we were walking up the very steep mountain paths, and we were going to visit the highest water well. And we had beads of sweat because it's hot there too in the summertime. And we stopped often to catch our breaths, and people invited us in to sit on the little chairs to rest a moment. And we would carry on walking up to the well. And he turned to me, and he said, "You know so many people here, and they know you. You can't keep this up, you know. You won't be objective. And besides, you will burn out." Well, his words gave me pause. I thought about what he had said, and I then thought that he had it exactly backwards. My relationship to people is personal, not objective. My work is personal. And only when personal is it possible to keep up the work over time, especially in demanding circumstances. Social justice then becomes very personal. If you'll bear with me, I have three stories about how the invisible world opened up to me. In Sudan, on the Ethiopian border, I was accompanying the death of a young boy, 14 years old. His father was there. They had just walked months to get to this camp. There was another nurse on the other side. And at the moment of death, I felt this breeze pass through me. And I turned to the woman and my fellow worker. I said, "Did you feel that?" And she said, "Yes, I did. What do you think it was?" And I said, "Well, I think it was his spirit leaving his body." And for the very first time in my life, I thought about that. At the moment of death, what happens? And I started to think about that invisible world. And realized that I had experienced, now I realize that I experienced several incidents that I'd like to share with you. Driving down the mountain from Tlamakasap, I was the only English speaker in the car, driving our old van. One person in front, three in the back. Suddenly, out of the woods, from behind a rock, these two men with bandanas and baseball caps and their jackets with guns yell, and they come running at us. My window was down, but I didn't really get it in the moment. And I said, "What?" Because I didn't understand what they had yelled at us, which was probably "Stop or we'll shoot," something like that. And I said, "What?" And all of a sudden, I heard this English voice, male, say, "Go." And I stepped on the gas. Automatically, instinctively. My driving might have killed us. Because by the time I stopped at the end of these curves, my knees were shaking and we got out of the van. They said, "Why did you do that? Why didn't you just stop?" I said, "Because this voice told me to go. And I just obeyed it." And when I thought about that later, I thought, something would have happened to us if we stopped. This was a guardian of some sort. Speaking English, I was the only one who would understand that, and no one else heard it. So am I hearing things, or is there a hand helping? I'm going to talk about Sochi. Me das permiso no de hablar de lo que nos pasó hace 2 años. 2 years ago. We're up on the second floor of the office, and three of us, Sochi, myself, and our office assistant. And we're correcting an error, a clarification. And Sochi says, "Oh, it really hurts. I have cramps." She goes to the washroom, she comes back. She sits down, and she's obviously in some pain. And I pass over that, thinking, "Oh, women's troubles." And I go downstairs saying, "You two can sort this out. I don't need to be here." And I go into the kitchen. And then suddenly, one of our German volunteers appears at the door and says, "Sochi's having a convulsion. You got to come." Well, that's old hat to us. We know that drill many times. I went running to the office, and there she is on the floor having a convulsion, and so because she has grand mal seizures. And those of us that work there, we know what to do, right? We protect the head, protect the arms. I say, "Hey, make sure she's not choking." And as she came to and then started convulsing again, this word appeared. It was like a banner. And it said ectopic. And when she came to, I asked, "Are you using family planning?" And she said, "No." Very groggy. She said, "I just want to go home." I said, "No, this is an ectopic pregnancy and it's rupturing. You have to go to hospital now." And she did, accompanied by our accountant. Gets to the hospital. She arrives at 11, at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. She's on the operating table. The surgeon takes 4 3/4 hours to clean up the rupture. At the end of the day, he said she was the crisis of the day and the miracle. Now, where did that word ectopic come from? I thought with my mind she was having a seizure. In fact, I could see it. Where does that help come from? I had to think about that. Now, Sochi says, Susan, you saved my life, as did the surgeon. And I said, I cannot take any responsibility for that. That word was sent to me. I was only a channel. But it indeed saved her life. And we have to think about those things, don't we? Last one. We're driving up to Tlama, and again, a young man comes out with a long rifle this time. And he stops right in front, like this. I'm driving, and he stops with a gun right here. And this time I do stop. There was no one telling me otherwise. I stop, he comes around, he rummages, he really takes the stuff we have. He disappears, and we were the 16th assault in the 1 month, number 16. And we went to report it. There's a long story occurring with that, but it turns out that he assaults another truck a couple days later, and he's in prison. And then the police station commander secretary phones and says, you have to come and identify him so that he can be charged. That was on a Sunday. I go to bed Sunday. 4 a.m, the room turns pink. It wakes me up. It's absolutely bathed in this soft pink color. I sit up in bed. I turn to the corner where there's more light, and I tell you not, I without a word of exaggeration, there is like an 8-foot angel standing there with wings. I saw her as clearly as I see Ruth sitting before me. And this angel, who was so tall, she says to me without moving her lips, it's like she impressed the words on my heart. I just knew what she had said. She said, don't worry, Susan. Everything is unfolding as it should. And then she dissolved. She disappeared, slowly. And then the light in the room went down, and it turned dark, nighttime again, and I laid down. In the morning, I'm coming down the stairs, and our geologist volunteer, who was there at the time, she says, Susan, you're sounding rather chipper. And I said, yes. Apparently someone has died, but I'm not to worry about it. Turns out, to make a long story short, the police had beaten this young man in hospital to the point of death. But I was not to worry about it, that everything was unfolding as it should. And that is what has sustained me over all the times, the hard times. I've thought a lot about those incidences. There are many more. As I've said many times, the real work of development lies in the creation of opportunity to try out something new, to risk and to stretch beyond what is known. And for me, the stretch has been in the question of faith. Do I have faith in the work that we are all collaborating to do? Well, I have to say now that's true. Yes, I do. If you had asked me when I first started, I was saying to my hosts this morning that I was raised in a family where my dad, bless his heart, dropped us at the corner of the church and said, go to church, I'll pick you up at X time. And so that question of belief has grown through many small incidences that I could not explain, the mystery of what was happening and the guidance that I personally received. And I learned to pay attention to it, to listen carefully. We live in a web of mutuality. That has become clear to me. That what happens in Tlama Kasapa affects us eventually here. What happens here certainly affects the people in many Mexican villages. In that process, as people heal, fear decreasing, confidence increasing. They become more empowered. They learn to stand up and say their own names. The strengthened spirit, it strengthens intention. It awakens new belief in the self, in the other, and in a greater power, in the Creator. This is what allows the wisdom of the heart to be sparked. It allows us to be brave, to step into new territory, unknown territory, to gather our courage and take action. Smart action, we gotta think about it. These experiences build belief, they build faith in self, in the others, and in God or Creator. Through daily practice, this is the part that I think is important for so many of us in Canada who are sleeping. Through daily practice, we lead with the reason of our hearts, understanding reality in a different way than when we work with the mind. And our heart is opened through spirit. We nurture loving relationships with all that is, recognizing that there is one humanity and one earth. Thank you for listening.